from the that opening prayer in the very beginning that I talked too long about. We generate this feeling of gratitude. And we take that and we recognize why we have this feeling of gratitude. Then we take refuge with that. Going, yeah, without these teachings of the Buddha, without the Buddha being so kind as to even give these teachings to us, because he could have just attained his enlightenment and been gone, done with it, been out of this place, but instead he hangs out for 4 years, 40, teaching and building this big community that has lasted almost 3,000 years. So we think, wow, so this is all really great. This is all very, very fantastic. Versus what I've had to this potential or possibility is so great. I take refuge in it again. So that opening of paying homage to the Buddha is actually a sneaky way of making you feel a sense of devotion. And that's what it's really supposed to do. So then you have this devotion for Shakyamuni Buddha and for his Dharma and for the community that we engage in. And so then we take refuge with that. And having taken refuge, we think of all of this has been offered to us. We as an individual are having these experiences in Dharma. And we wish them upon all others. So there's the four immeasurables. Then we compact the entire puja into just seven lines. And we have this seven-line prayer that we do. And then we go into offerings. So offerings are, if you're super happy and excited about someone who's done something really great for you, you tend to want to give them gifts around the holidays. Well, in the Buddhism, every Sunday's holiday. So we think, wow, you know, or every day that we do puja's holiday. So we're showering these gifts out of our devotion. Not because we're expecting something in return, not because we have to. You shouldn't be doing it for that. But you should be doing it because look at what you're benefiting. And it's not like, you know, we're charging you tens of thousands of dollars for this secret. Right? You get those all the time, you know. The first 10 people that call this number, you get this fantastic teaching. And then if you're not the 10th person, you know, you got to pay us $30,000 for these deep secrets. Or join this course. It's only $400 a week. I mean, we ask for membership dues and donations, but that's in order to pay rent and whatever bills that we might have, like the internet. Because if we don't have that, I'll see you guys later. You're going to have to meet in somebody's living room or something. You're not going to have a nice place to visit in. It's not going to be a temple. Without the internet, I'm not going to see you guys. I mean, that's all we're asking for, the membership dues. I don't get a paycheck. Nobody's getting paid from this. Nobody's making any money off of it. Let's just keep this thing alive. So we give this stuff because we're just so excited about the potential and what has happened for us with engaging the Dharma. So we do all of these different offerings. We call it extensive offering because we're going through these lists. Long lists. Oh, yeah, so there's all this stuff. I don't even know what I'm offering. I'm just offering. We'll have a class on this someday. Of what all this stuff means. So that means a lot to the Buddha, even though you're like, he wants a horse? Fine, I'll visualize a horse and give it to the Buddha. What does he need a horse for? He doesn't even ride one. Fair enough. And then we come to the mandala offering. And the mandala offering is this huge sum of the whole thing. It would be like, you know, winning a few dollars here and there at the casino. And the mandala is hitting the jackpot. Not just where you win the shiny car that's up on the spinning table, but you actually get all the money in the casino's coffers. So $65 billion is now yours. That's the mandala. It's like the whole package. But here's the deep secret. You are actually the mandala. So when it's time to give the mandala offering, you're actually just giving all of your energy nodes, all of your channels, all of your drops and your winds. And if you don't know what any of that is, that's fine. But you are giving the self. Specifically, you're giving the petty tyrant self. Didn't know that, did you? Yeah, you're giving your ego to the Buddha on a golden dish that's been sprinkled with water and perfume and throwing flowers all over it, and then you put a little apple in the mouth of the ego, makes him be quiet because he can't talk while that apple's stuffed in his mouth, and then you stick him on this plate and you decorate it and you put garlands and all more flowers and more perfume and incense and all this stuff, and you just keep piling on to trying to make your ego look fantastic. And then you offer it away. There it is. There's my ego. What happens when you give a gift away?
It's not yours anymore.
Not yours anymore. Quit clinging to it. You can't have it anymore. It's no longer yours. It belongs to somebody else. And you say, but I still think that I exist. That's the trickery. That's the whole trick. So when we come to the mandala offering, we should be just like jumping out of our skin. This is how we should be. When we get to the mandala, we should be so happy that if we were any more happier, we would be twins. You'd have to jump out of yourself and have another one because there's just not enough to contain it all. That's where we should be at the mandala. So excited that we're going to offer the self away because we're such a state of devotion, we don't even care. We don't even need that anymore. In fact, it's weighting us down. How do we know it's weighting us down? Well, we can't even jump out of our seat. You see? It's too heavy. It's sitting on your lap, and it won't even let you get up. It won't even let you jump up and do prostrations. It won't let you do anything. It's too heavy, so you give it away. And by the time you're at the mandala, you're like dancing on tables. Your heart's just exploding with all of this loving kindness and compassion and all this gooiness towards yourself and others and the three jewels and three roots. And I mean, you're just, wow. This is a pure land. In the moment, you generate the pure land. That's what you're living in. And you're ready to go. Most of the time we have a sutra reading right after the mandala, and so we think, okay, now we're just going to get we're going to get more. And that's just way too damn exciting, because the last time I heard any kind of a sutra and the discourse on the sutra, the commentary on the sutra, it changed my whole life. It ruined everything. Look, I'm no longer an alcoholic. I no longer sleep too much. Changed everything. I no longer hate my boss. I no longer hate my neighbor. I look in the mirror. I don't hate myself anymore. How fantastic is that? Why? Well, because we got to hear some verses. And somebody explained what those mean. And I went home and thought about it, and bang. It's impacted me like this. And now they're going to give me even more? Well, that's just crazy. That's like winning the lottery every week. And I didn't even buy a ticket. And I'm still winning. And that's how we approach sutra reading. It should be like that. Does that mean we're not going to have tough times? Oh, come on. That's what this is about. I mean, we're doing all this because everything is tough. Everything's difficult. But we don't have to make it extra difficult. The whole point of the Buddha is overcome suffering. That's his whole topic. That's his whole platform. Let's end suffering. You can't end suffering by suffering in suffering. You can't end suffering by moping about suffering. You can't end suffering by going, oh, this enlightenment is going to be so brutally heavy. That's not happiness. That's not joyful. Oh, these practices. Oh, they're so tough because now I have to get up 10 minutes earlier every morning before work. They're killing me. Well, if it's killing you, then stop doing it, because that's not the point. The point is that you should be like, woohoo, I get to do this. Because look at the impact on me when I do it. Look at the change that happens when I do it. Look at how I feel when I do it. This is what it's about. It's what it's supposed to be about. Listen, none of us are monks. Don't pretend to be one. Monks are the guys that aren't allowed to do anything. That's not you. We're not supposed to emulate them. We're not supposed to pretend to be like them. In fact, we're supposed to do everything opposite of them. We have the tougher job. Because we're the ones that have to live in the real world. Not the fantasy world in some ivory tower somewhere where our biggest problem is whether our broom works or not. I mean, that's their biggest challenge. They told me to sweep the parking lot, but the broom they gave me only has two sticks, and I can't get this cigarette butt to get into the dustpan. And that's your, like, crisis. How many of you have a problem slightly bigger than that on a daily basis? Does anyone? I know mine is kind of looking at the checkbook going, oh my God, how the hell am I going to pay rent? How do I pay this next bill? And then I got to go clean the yard. And I got to go to work. And I got to do this. And I got to do that. That's way bigger than whether my broom works. And for me, if the broom doesn't work, I just go to Menards and get another one. Because I don't have time for that. I got too many problems. Right? So Buddha says, you householders, live life. Take your life back. Take back your primordial happiness. Take back your primordial joy. Take back your enlightenment. Stop making the world so heavy. It's already heavy enough. It doesn't need more. So when the crisis comes, you say, oh, well, thank goodness I have, like, Dharma to turn to. I've got Sangha to turn to. I can go to Dharma teachers. I can go back to the guru. I can do all these different things. I can start singing. I can do a mantra. I can do meditation. I can follow the breath. I have all these tools to cope. Does it suck? Well, yes, in the moment it does. But I also know, because the Buddha has taught me this, it won't stay forever. And the moment it's gone, we're going to party. And how do we party? We let ourselves be joyful. We let ourselves take time to experience the wonders of the five senses. We're allowed to enjoy what we hear that's enjoyable, or see that's enjoyable, or taste, or touch, or smell, or any of those other things. You're allowed to express it. And in fact, you should be practicing the expression of that. The only thing we have to tame is not being so attached to it when it goes away, and not rejecting it when it comes. That's it. That's your whole practice. And in between all of that, be as happy as possible. Even if you have to fake it. Because the alternative is the thing that Dharma is here to destroy, which is suffering, sorrow, negativity, all of that crap. So stop doing it to yourself. Just don't. This your life in this physical form is not worth wasting the time on it. And if you live like this, you're going to trick yourself into enlightenment. You're going to trick yourself into liberation. I'm telling you the truth. That's what's going to happen. You're not going to get it from sitting around going, I'm following my breath like the text tells me. That's not going to give you enlightenment or liberation. That is a tool in order to see the activity of the mind or to see how the senses work. But that's not enough. You have to light the lamp inside of you. Let the joy come out. Generate it yourself. I don't care what it is. Find your favorite kind of incense. Burn it and enjoy the smell of it. Make a meal that you really enjoy and enjoy it. Let yourself actually savor it. If you hear a song you like, well, sure, we would prefer it to be a spiritual song or something wholesome. But if you're not there, that's fine. Enjoy your music. Find the happiness that the Buddha is talking about and start doing that. That's what these bodhisattvas did. They were householders that just refused to be negative. In fact, Avalokitesvara, who was just so insanely joyful and happy, when he thought about those who were not, it made him burst into tears. Because he could not handle the concept of people beating themselves up over nothing. And he was so overwhelmed with the idea, how in the world are we going to teach these people to be happy? And the Buddha said, Manjushri, or Avalokitesvara, you're a great, great bodhisattva of immense compassion because of this thing. And so you look at him, and he's always, you know, sitting, he's always lounging. Because he's so comfortable in his own skin, because he allows himself just to be happy. That's all it is. Manjushri was the same way. You know, his image always has a sword that's on the fire, this flaming sword. Why? Because his whole thing was this all of this pain and suffering is the darkness of ignorance. So if we light a torch, that'll remove all of the shadows and the doubt and all of this dense heaviness and suffering. And he's like, but I'm going further than that. I'm going to light a sword on fire. So if the flame doesn't work, I'm still going to cut through whatever it is that's blocking it. Because people need to be happy. And the Buddha went, Manjushri, that's just so fantastic. I'm going to call you the Bodhisattva of great wisdom. Vajrapani, who could never sit still, always singing and dancing and just going crazy, is like, that's it. I'm going to make practices where that's all we're going to do, is we're just going to like bliss ourselves out in yoga. And the whole Buddhist Tantra system comes from Vajrapani Bodhisattva. And he writes all of these ecstatic meditations. Dynamic meditations. They're all supposed to be sung. None of them are ever supposed to be spoken. And in fact, they're all accompanied with dances. But rarely do we see Buddhist dance, do we? Very rare. I have no idea why. In all the studies my guru gives me, every single one of these comes with a tremendous amount of music and a dance. And some of them three or four dances. And crazy costumes. I mean, really crazy costumes. Why? Because they're supposed to be like this. I'll show you. How many of you have ever seen part of my crazy costume? See that? See this? Who walks around in this? Change that so move the camera up so they can see this hat. Right? Who's going to walk around town looking like this? Why would we? It's called a lotus hat. You know, when we got these, my guru says, all right, everybody, here, you know, here's your hats. He's passing them out. Put them on. And we're all like, do we really have to wear this? He's like, put it on. So we all put it on, and I mean, I just started laughing because we all look like kids at a birthday party or something. And he says, now everybody's going to get up and you're going to start dancing and play your bell and your drum and your whole, you know, and the what? What kind of Buddhism is this? It's the kind that, for some reason in the West, we don't think is Buddhism. We think we constantly have to be walking around with this real heaviness, all because mindfulness is so heavy. It's so serious. Actually, mindfulness is anti-serious. Because it doesn't pay attention to any stories. And any story that pops up, you just, ha! That's a funny one. And you keep going. Until the next one comes up, and you go, ooh, that's a good one too. That's what we're supposed to be doing. And after, you know, 20 years of this stuff, I'm finally doing what my teacher told me to do, which was to put our service to music. Why? Because in the very beginning, and in fact, I'll tell you this, he wanted us to have like guitars and drum kits and all this, and I was totally against it. Yeah, right? The student against the teachings of the teacher. Does that sound appropriate? But that, I mean, that was my whole thing. No, I don't want to do that. But back then, I was coming from a place where I used to teach music. And I was in all kinds of bands, and I did all that stuff back then. And I didn't want to do that because I thought spirituality needs to be like this ignorant thing. Where we just, you know, are always so calm and like we're monks, brain dead vegetables. The most thing we can do is, oh, Amitofo. What the hell kind of happiness is that? You really think the Buddha actually acted like that? That's crazy. People that act like that do not draw hundreds of thousands of people to come and see them. But somehow in the West, that's what we think it all is. We think it's this austere thing. Because we look at the Japanese, or we looked at whatever it was that we looked at in the 70s and went, see, there's no happiness in it. In the meantime, there's Hare Krishnas dancing all over Central Park. And they're all freaking out with tambourines and drums. And here's the Buddhists going, oh, well, we're not going to act like that. We're going to act like Japanese and stare at a fucking wall. As if that's going to somehow enlighten us. If you want to try it, find a wall, sit in front of it, and see if enlightenment comes to you. If it does, I'll buy your book, I promise. But I don't know anybody that sat looking at a wall that attained enlightenment. In fact, all those Japanese masters attained their enlightenment in really bizarre ways, like a bird poops on him while he's sailing over to China. And he thinks it's so funny that it poops on him that he laughs himself into enlightenment. That's a true story. We have one of the greatest teachers ever to live in Japan, and he gives up, he's the patriarch, he's in charge of the entire Rinzai line, and he decides, this is crap, I'm leaving, I'm never going to live in a monastery again. And you know what he does? He takes his robes, and he goes down to the seaport, and he finds a local bar, and he goes into the bar, and he says, that's it. Anyone wants Dharma, they got to come in the bar, because there's great music in here, there's cocktails and food, and this is what I'm going to do. There's dancers up on the stage, that's it. I'm tired of this sitting around staring at walls. And he is one of the greatest teachers to ever come out of Japan. After he did that. Before he did that, nobody cared. He's one of the patriarchs. We don't even know what number. Now everybody knows his name. In Japan, he's revered, one of the greatest teachers. Buddha loved festivals. Loved them. Loved playing with the elephants, loved the cows, everything. Just enjoyed life all the time to the point where he sees a flower and he just flips out because it's so great. Let's do that. Let's work ourselves into a state where we can flip out when we see a tree and think, by God, that's amazing. I don't even know if I can find another one like it. You ever thought about that? All the trees that you see, can you ever find another one like it? Drives me crazy that I can't. So let's dedicate some merit so that we can actually do this. We can live like the Bodhisattvas did. And let's share it with the entire world, because the moment we actually become this, we'll perfume the world to do the same. They'll follow suit. It'll change everything. You find a happy person to come into an environment and they brighten everything. We should do that. Following the example.